You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us this morning at the Tax Policy Center event. Today, we're featuring a new book by Michael Gratz and Ian Shapiro. It's called The Wolf at the Door, The Menace of Economic Insecurity and How to Fight It. It looks like this. It is a very good book. I will not try to steal the author's thunder by describing the book, except to say that I read it, I really liked it, and I wanted to hold an event on it. So we're fortunate to have Michael here today participating in today's event, and we have an excellent panel discussing these findings. Michael Gratz joined the Columbia Law School faculty in 2009 after 25 years at Yale Law School, where he is the professor emeritus. He's written on a wide range of topics in tax and social insurance issues. His recent scholarship has focused on social justice, economic insecurity. In 2016, he wrote a book called The Burger Court and the Rise of the Judicial Right with Linda Kareenhouse. He's also held several positions in the federal government. I first met him when he was assistant to the secretary and special counsel for the Department of the Treasury during the George H.W. Bush administration, and deputy assistant secretary for tax policy in 90 and 91. On top of all his formal accomplishments and publications, let me just say I've been involved in tax policy for more than three decades now. I find Michael to be one of the wisest, most sensible, most thoughtful people in the field addressing tax and social policy issues. So, Michael, we welcome you. I'm delighted to have you here this morning. After Michael's presentation, we'll have three panelists. Camille Poussette is a senior fellow in governance studies and economic studies and metropolitan studies here at the Brookings Institution. She's the head of the Race, Prosperity, and Inclusion Initiative and has held several earlier positions, done work on systemic racism, the economic advancement of Black and Native American boys, and a variety of other issues. She'll be followed by Bob Greenstein, who's the founder and the head of the Center on Budget Policy Priorities here in Washington. Bob is a legend in public policy circles in D.C., and I will leave it at that. He'll be followed by Neera Tanden, who's the president and CEO of the Center for American Progress, where she focuses on both on how organizations can fill their missions to expand opportunity for all Americans. She's served in both the Obama and Clinton administrations and as well on a variety of campaigns. So we have an excellent panel. We have a superb author. And with that, Michael, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Bill. And thanks to Brookings for having this conference and to all the people behind the scenes making it work. I also want to thank especially Camille, Bob, and Neera for agreeing to be commentators today. It's a great pleasure to see all of you here. I should say at the outset that our book is unusual because it is a book about both policy and politics. There are terrific books on policy, and there are excellent books on politics, but there are very few books that combine a discussion of politics with a discussion of policy. And although our book is about legislative politics and not electoral politics, it was to some extent motivated by the 2016 elections when political charlatans in both the United States and in England were promising to provide a better life for precarious workforces and their families in both countries. But we're peddling what I would call snake oil solutions, that is, things like Brexit or tariffs or a big wall at the southern border of the United States, things that were not going to make people's lives significantly better, as the politicians had promised. When our book was published in February, the unemployment rate in the United States was the lowest it had been in 50 years. And then a few months later, because of the virus, the unemployment rate was the highest it had been in 90 years. But even in February, when the unemployment rate was low, the Federal Reserve had produced its annual or biannual survey in which 44% of American families said that they did not have the ability to pay off a $400 emergency with either cash or credit card that they could pay off by the end of the month. And now, of course, with the virus, emergencies are far more than $400 a month for so many American families. When we looked at the causes of this precariousness, we were concerned that the spotlight had really not shone on how precarious the American family was and how tenuous their job security was in the United States. And the effect that losses and the potential for losses, and particularly the potential for job losses, was creating a widespread fear, anxiety, and resentment among a wide swath of the American public. The causes for this are now, I think, fairly well known, beginning in the 1970s with imports from Japan and Germany of cars and steel and textiles. The U.S. manufacturing base began to hollow out. And as it did so, cities and locations throughout the United States were also hollowed out. American presidents and presidential candidates have for 40 years now been visiting Youngstown, Ohio, and promising to bring back the manufacturing jobs that employed over 23,000 workers in Youngstown during its heyday as a steel manufacturing city. But today, the city of Youngstown has fewer than 4,000 employees. Its population has dwindled by half. And the steel factory, the biggest steel factory in Youngstown, which is producing rolled steel for pipelines, has 300 workers and very large robots and other technological pieces that are putting out the steel that that plant sells. Four more of those plants and you'd have only 1,200 more workers. And so this is really a problem that, despite all the promises, has proved difficult to solve. And it's not only places like Youngstown that have been hurt by globalization. Hickory, North Carolina, one of the great furniture manufacturing cities in the country, was hit by Chinese imports and had to move from making furniture to custom upholstery and some technology businesses that have moved to Hickory. As we looked at this, our conclusion was that the dislocations from globalization really peaked around a decade ago. And the risks going forward are due to technology and technological changes. And if anything, the virus has made the prospect of disruptions in the workforce due to technological advances even more pressing, and job security even more risky. It is unlikely, I think, that the technological conveyor belt will run backwards over time. We've also had slow growth, as everybody knows, an aging population, and importantly, the collapse of private sector labor unions. And that's important not only economically, because it decreases the voice that the workforce has with its employers, but also importantly politically, because there is now not an important counterforce speaking for the average worker in the state and federal legislatures of the nation. All of this has made it harder to govern. It has led voters to demand risky political change, and it has given a rise to anti-elite groups and sentiments within the political parties. When we turn to policy in this book, we focus on jobs, and we focus on jobs because the behavioral economics literature is clear that people are much more concerned about losses than they are about potential gains and the risks that have been posed to them in terms of uncertainties about their ongoing ability to earn a living wage for their families have created anxieties that have not only affected our political process, but also affect dramatically family life in the United States. And the virus, of course, has demonstrated just how precarious those jobs are in America today. On a policy front, we look to policies that we believe will enhance economic security by producing jobs. And in that context, we look principally to infrastructure, which includes not only bridges and roads and trains and airports in the United States, which are in a terrible shape by all accounts, but we also look to broadband in rural areas, such as what's now happening in Wisconsin and northern Missouri. In order to make wages pay better, make jobs pay better for average Americans, we discuss several different options, but we land on the benefits that have been provided both at the federal level and the state level through the Earned Income Tax Credit. And we urge expansions in the coverage of the Earned Income Tax Credit and moving Earned Income Tax Credits higher into the income scale and other ideas for that. Both in the case of infrastructure and in the case of the Earned Income Tax Credit, there have been bipartisan support within both the federal legislature and in the state legislatures. Earned Income Tax Credits have been enhanced in not only blue states, but in red states across the country as Bob knows especially well. We also are concerned with things that pose risks to families' ability to work, and we talk about the need to move our health insurance system off and away from relying on employers, something that the virus has made all too vivid for way too many American families. We talk about building on universal pre-K programs that have been successful, again, in both red states and blue cities, and building on child care programs that have been successful, such as that of the Department of Defense. One of the important chapters of the book, and the one I want to spend the last few minutes of my time on, is a chapter which we call From Unemployment to Reemployment. And here the idea is to protect people from unemployment. The unemployment insurance system in the United States, which is an artifact of the New Deal and was enacted by Franklin Roosevelt in 1935, 85 years ago, in the shadow of lurking constitutional constraints that although he knew the country needed a national program of unemployment insurance, moved him to propose the kind of state unemployment insurance system that we have had ever since. The unemployment insurance system we have has produced a race to the bottom among the states. Mississippi has covered about 9% of unemployed workers in recent years, Florida 11%. The benefits are so low that they don't keep a low and moderate income family from poverty. And so the unemployment insurance system has been actually the weakest link in the U.S. system of social insurance. And that system, as we all know, is not a very strong safety net across the board. Unemployment insurance does not cover independent contractors or part-time workers or temporary workers. According to economists, those workers accounted for over 90% of the job growth between 2005 and 2015. And the weakness of the unemployment insurance system was proved when Congress and the CARES Act had to create its own new temporary, unfortunately temporary, unemployment insurance system. We argue that the unemployment insurance system should be combined with the programs of another unsuccessful program, that is trade adjustment assistance. Trade adjustment assistance was originally enacted in the Kennedy administration in an effort to protect workers who lost their jobs because of the movement at that time, which of course has continued toward lowering tariffs and removing barriers to international trade. Trade adjustment assistance was never very robust. It was very difficult for workers to prove that the reasons they lost their jobs was because of international trade. Congress never funded it in a robust way. For many, many years, not one worker was able to get the benefits promised by trade adjustment assistance. But the program itself had important components, and those components are retraining. In our book, we look to the community colleges, which have actually been quite successful across the United States in retraining workers for new jobs. The trade adjustment assistance was supposed to provide relocation assistance for those workers who had to move to new places because of where the jobs were. Our proposal is one that we call universal adjustment assistance, and we believe that the moment has come for that kind of program to be taken up by the Congress. It is difficult. Our book talks a lot, and I'm hoping that some of the commentators will mention this, but our book talks a lot about the need in legislative politics for coalitions. And the problem that we've had with improving our unemployment insurance system over all these years is that while everyone expects and hopes to be a retired person and will join the American Association of Retired People, there is no association of the future unemployed. And so forming a coalition for this kind of project is more difficult. But we are strongly of the view that businesses have a large incentive to improve the unemployment insurance and the adjustment assistance programs for their workers, and that it is consistent with their talk about taking into account the needs of their the needs of their employees and their communities, in addition to the long-standing attention they have paid to the needs of their shareholders. I'm out of time. I could go on, but I do want to hear from the commentators, as I'm sure you do. I just want to close by saying that when we wrote our book, the wolf was at the door, and now for far too many Americans and their families, the wolf is in the house. Thank you.
So I wanted to take off where Michael left off. Michael, thank you for that excellent, excellent synopsis of your terrific book. I just want to say a couple things before I get into the meat of my comments. And the first thing is I do want to say that this this book did a phenomenal job of making making it very accessible for the average person. You know, talk about political economy that is intentionally practical about policy solutions. And I really appreciate that. So I really recommend it as a very, very accessible read. I do have a few comments on the thesis of the book, namely that insecurity is the critical issue that we need to address rather than inequality. And I have a couple of observations about this. And what I like about the focus on insecurity in particular is that it does indeed, I think, capture the experiences of many Americans. The inability to cover current expenses, the inability to save for emergencies or for the future, and the absence of disposable income to have choices in your life. And this reality is distressingly real and current for millions of Americans. It was true when this book was going to print, and even more true and more broadly shared now in the COVID-19 pandemic. But what I want to do is make a couple of caveats to that discussion about the importance of insecurity and the focus on insecurity in the book. First, inequality isn't totally irrelevant, in my view. People experience inequality not in the way that macro economists talk about it, like a Gini coefficient, but they experience it when they compare themselves to others. And I think there's sufficient evidence to indicate that working class whites in the US see themselves falling, at least this is prior to the pandemic, saw themselves falling behind Blacks economically. And that sense of inequality, together with their economic insecurity, which is real, can in fact drive political behavior. So I do think economic inequality is, you know, alive and well, but maybe not as a concept, but as an experience. And I think, again, one of the strong points of this book is really talking about the experiences. The second thing I wanted to say about insecurity is that there are different kinds of insecurity. And what I mean by that is that the type of insecurity that's described in this book has been a way of life for millions of people of color in the US for decades due to a range of intentionally discriminatory policies that I'm not going to go over here, but are well known. I think this book is describing the increased insecurity of white working class and lower middle class Americans, for whom insecurity is a relatively new phenomenon. And so I want to get back to that later in my comments, because I think this is actually hugely important for developing goals and for creating and sustaining coalitions, which is now what I want to talk about. So what I think one of the most important, compelling parts of the book is this section on forming and maintaining coalitions. I think it's rare for a book that focuses on macroeconomics to also have a very, very pragmatic and very sound advice on how to devise a strategy to move public policy forward in the legislative process. So Michael and Ian, I think, make the case that public policy requires coalitions, and that successful coalitions that are successful at moving policy ahead need to have goals that are achievable. They need to neutralize or embrace business interests. They need leadership, moral commitments, resources, and also they need to show intermediate successes on the way to whatever their ultimate goal is in order to keep coalitions together. And so I want to speak about each of those individually, because I think these are actually very, very important to moving public policy ahead generally. And I love the way it's laid out here in the book. So first of all, on having goals, I think Michael and Ian did a nice job of talking about how particularly like the Occupy Wall Street movement, which did not have goals, movements that don't have goals don't last very long. And so having goals is important. It's important for organizing coalitions. It's important for also measuring how successful the coalition is. And so obviously you need to have goals. And that may seem obvious, but there have been movements like Occupy Wall Street, which actually didn't have goals. So whether it seems obvious or not, the contrary has actually also happened. They make a very interesting argument in this book that you also need a moral commitment, arguing that people who are really morally committed to a particular goal are likely to last in a coalition even when there are setbacks. And I think that's incredibly important. And I think you see this a lot now currently around climate change and environmental justice, for which there are a myriad setbacks, particularly here in the U.S. And yet there are folks who are just incredibly passionate and morally committed. And that does keep that movement and that coalition moving ahead. Very interesting discussion on business interests. Just to sum up the argument here, the general argument is that business interests are incredibly powerful. Money talks, and if you are unable to neutralize business interests as you're supporting your goals, or unable to embrace business interests, that you're likely to get derailed, because money will be flowing in a way that advances interests that are opposite to yours. So important to deal with corporate and business interests. And then there's also a discussion about resourcing and how business interests are also important in resourcing. They're not the only source of resources, but any coalition that intends to be successful, particularly on large public policy issues, needs to have sufficient resources. A very good discussion about leadership, how leadership is critical, obviously, to motivating people, to making sure that there's a fair amount of discipline, and to actually moving the ship forward towards those proximate goals. And then, of course, the discussion about intermediate successes. So you can have a goal, and it can be pretty far out there, and far out there in public policy land is like 3 to 4 years. And it's hard to keep together a coalition that has varying interests unless you can show intermediate successes. So a great and recent example of this is in the state of Virginia, which has recently had a change of government where Democrats are now in charge of the state houses and the governorship. And so they've been trying to make a lot of changes with respect to police brutality, racial justice, et cetera, many of those things which will be realized much further down the road. But in order to keep a coalition together, they've done some interesting things, like they removed Confederate statues and renamed boulevards, et cetera. And those are all, you know, one might say, pretty cosmetic. And but they also generate energy around small term wins. And so that's, again, very, very important for moving a coalition ahead. So I think that's incredibly important. And I think the way that this has been discussed in the book is particularly helpful when we think about something as large as unemployment, which is what I want to return to now. So, we obviously have to focus now on generating jobs. But we're in a different situation than we might have been sort of post Great Recession, in that we now have a whole national conversation about the importance of racial equity as we move forward to creating a better employment picture. And so this is taking place, this whole discussion about generating jobs and equitable jobs is taking place in a political context where, because of the constitutional parameters of representation, gerrymandering, and the importance of money, both corporate and wealthy donor money, in our legislative process, we have a representative government that is actually more conservative than the electorate. So the question that arises here is, in the context of a representative government that is more conservative than the electorate, how do you put together successful coalitions that can engage with and incorporate the equity concerns around employment? And so how do you focus on equitable employment given the fact that you have a more conservative representative sort of government? And so how does the advice that we've gotten here around successful coalitions really intersect with the reality of a more conservative representative government and these equity concerns? So one of the things I want to add to this conversation, I think we can come back and talk about it afterwards, is that often public policy coalitions really stand on a foundation of what the general narrative is around what is possible and what is not possible in public policy, and understandings and assumptions about who is going to be advantaged and who's going to be disadvantaged. And rarely does public policy move beyond those parameters of narrative. But what I'm going to say here is that in addition to all the excellent advice that Michael and Evan have provided around coalitions, is that in order to change the employment picture and make it more equitable as we're trying to move the economy ahead in a post-COVID world, we're also going to have to broaden that narrative around how Americans actually get ahead. And the narrative we have now is that it's all about individual effort. And I think we need to broaden that narrative in such a way that you can form coalitions that are all interested, all the members of which are interested in equitable distribution of employment gains. And that narrative has to be broadened in the following way. We have to acknowledge that some of us are born with tailwinds, some of us are born with headwinds economically. And I think if we can switch the narrative to something like that, then we can put together a coalition around employment gains that is not necessarily advancing one group, but takes into account the kinds of equity gains that we all want to see. I'm going to stop there and invite Bob to join us for his comments.
Well, thank you. This is an excellent and important book. And I think that if it's read and absorbed by many in the policy community, it could contribute to moving policy debates in positive directions. As we've heard, the book places a particular focus on economic security and policy responses to it, with an emphasis on policy changes that could win broad backing from coalitions and actually become law. The book focuses on feasible gains that can be achieved, not just on aspirational goals that may seem out of reach for years to come. And the book notes in a key observation that the way to get to big goals over time is, one, through a series of what the authors call proximate steps that significantly reduce economic security and improve millions of people's lives themselves, but two, where these proximate steps also put you on a path towards the next big step so that you're steadily getting closer to big goals over time. In a memorable sentence, the book says, and I'm quoting, "The disciplined pursuit of proximate goals is the key to advancing distributive agendas." And it emphasizes, and again, I'm quoting, "proximate goals that can become way stations on the road to a better future." Various examples come to mind. Take the Affordable Care Act. It was a big proximate gain. It covered 20 million more people. But it's also put us in a place where now the policy world is broadly talking about the next major steps, and I think we'll likely see action on them in the next 2 years if Vice President Biden wins the election, particularly if Democrats also control the Senate, so that the ACA both cover 20 million more people, but it's also a way station towards the larger goal of universal coverage. Or you could take refundable tax credits. The earned income tax credit used to be tiny, and the child tax credit used to be non-refundable, so that tens of millions of the very families and kids that needed it most were shut out. Through a series of proximate gains, these two credits together now lift more Americans out of poverty than anything other than Social Security. And the gains made to date hopefully will be way stations. I think it's distinctly possible that in the next few years, we will see both further expansion of the earned income credit and, of particular note in my view, making the child tax credit fully refundable so the poorest children benefit, making it effectively into a kind of a children's allowance. And how did we get to the point where these may really be possibilities in the next 2 years? Well, there were proximate gains in one or both of these credits in 1984, 1990, 1993, 1997, 2001, 2008, 2009, and 2015. Another theme of the book, which Camille noted, is that it's extremely difficult to make these advances in the face of unified, and I want to underscore the word unified, unified business opposition, which then, of course, suggests that the key here is to avoid unified business opposition, to neutralize or split what might otherwise be business opposition. Again, think of the Affordable Care Act. The NFIB opposed it, but the business roundtable stayed neutral, and various elements of the health industry supported it. If Democrats win the coming election, it should certainly be possible, in my view, to build on the Affordable Care Act, improve subsidies, make major gains in coverage. A really interesting question will be, what about the public option? So the public option will face unified opposition from the health industry, but the health industry is not the total business community. So it raises the question of, can there be elements of the business community that would see a public option as beneficial to them by enabling their employees to get good coverage without the employer having to provide it? Whether the unified business opposition we'd expect on the health side can be countered in this way from other elements of the business community, I think is likely to play a large role in whether the public option successfully can be enacted into law. With that, let me turn to the book's agenda, where it lays out, Michael's talked about many of these, a specific set of proposals. One, a substantially enlarged earned income tax credit. Two, major investment in infrastructure and related jobs. Three, unemployment trade adjustment assistance reform. Four, a path to universal health coverage. Five, major advances in affordable care. Six, universal preschool. I think this is a strong list, but I would add a few elements to it. As I noted earlier, there is a potential to get the child tax credit into a fully refundable credit. This would be a very important step forward. This is the centerpiece of a several-year-old National Academy of Science report on how to cut child poverty in half. Secondly, I would couple the book's call for major investments in child care with major investments in affordable housing with reference on low and moderate income renters. Only one in four low-income renter households with needs that would qualify it for assistance get any aid at all now because the funding for low-income housing and housing affordability is so limited. Third, a subsidized jobs program that helps those temporarily who have difficulty entering the job market and that could scale up when the economy goes down. And fourth, an increase in the minimum wage. Here's one of my few disagreements with the passage in the book. The book worries that coupling an increase in the minimum wage with an increase in the earned income credit, that seeking to do that would undercut support for the EITC expansion. I actually think the reverse. I think in the 2020s, it would be harder to achieve an EITC expansion unless it is married to an increase in the minimum wage, and that the two complement each other extremely well on the policy front, and that it would be a positive to advance both of them. In reading the book, I found myself having some questions as to, I wonder how the authors view another great need, immigration reform, in relation to the issues they discuss in the book. And I'd love to hear from Michael later in this session, his thinking on that. Finally, let me turn to taxes. The book calls for substantial changes to the tax code to raise substantially more revenue and to also secure more revenue through increased enforcement, both of which, in my view, are critically important. Let me make a note here for something that's suddenly very current. There's a part of the book that talks about, yes, we need to raise significantly more revenue from people with high income and wealth, but we probably shouldn't pursue, the book argues, pursue that through an explicit wealth tax because of fear that the Supreme Court could strike down the wealth tax is unconstitutional. The book was written months ago, but that concern goes up with the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett. Let me be clear, neither the book nor I are expressing criticism on policy grounds of a wealth tax. I'd love to see one. But the point here is if you want to get big tax increases enacted into law, the stars only align so often. And if you could get the stars to align and you used it up on a wealth tax that the court then declared unconstitutional, and I think with Barrett's addition, the odds would be well above 50-50 that the court would declare it unconstitutional, even though many top legal scholars think that would be the wrong conclusion. Likely that's where the court would go. By the time the court did that, you could have had a midterm election that changed control of Congress and you couldn't put anything in its place. So if one really wants to raise, and I think we should, significantly more revenue there, there are other ways to substantially tax high income and wealth. Raise the capital gains rate, tax unrealized capital gains at death, institute an inheritance tax, and more. But these kinds of political economy feasibility discussions are at the heart of the book and part of what makes it, in my view, such a strong book. To me, the bottom line about this book is that it doesn't just talk or pontificate about economic insecurity, but it goes well beyond that. It does the hard thinking to try to come up with how over the years ahead we could actually make major progress through measures that could actually be enacted, implemented, and politically sustained. And with that, let me turn it over to Neera.
Great. Excellent. It's a profound pleasure for me to be with so many esteemed speakers, but it's really just a fantastic pleasure to be speaking about this book with a person I would call Professor Gratz, because he was my professor a very long time ago. I learned a tremendous amount from him in law school. And a real pleasure of this book is that I get to continue learning from him in the context of this book. I will try to make a few additional points that won't retread the ground that Bob and Camille touched on. And I think I would go in a slightly different direction on some comments here, which is, I think that change is, the book recognizes the importance of some critical structural changes, and then outlines a very practical path to making those changes. And that's important and critical, and I think it's a real service, because so often in public policy discussions, the discussion is really absent an understanding of how to make real change. But I want us to think just about where we are as a country and think through how change is so difficult until you have a moment where it is less difficult. And the conversation on public policy has dramatically expanded over the last several months. Just as a reminder, basically in a weekend, the Congress passed $2.5 trillion of spending and investment to address the coronavirus. I think that is a fundamental shift and reorganizes the public policy discussion in Washington. And I think that because I think that's been demonstrated in a myriad number of ways. One, Vice President Biden's policy agenda has expanded, generally in a primary, when you go from a primary to a general election, the conversation, the public policy debates, the proposals tend to move in a more moderate direction. This is a very different time where the level of investment Vice President Biden has articulated has dramatically expanded over the last several months. And that is a function of several features, but one fundamental feature, which is that the virus itself, the coronavirus itself, has expanded the public policy discourse in the United States, in my view. I wrote a piece a few months ago on a new social contract, and there's actually tremendous overlap between the policy items I outline in my piece and the many agenda items from expanding childcare and investing in infrastructure and addressing these essential economic security issues. But I think that we shouldn't, this book was written before the virus, but I do want to hold on one issue here, which is the virus itself is a unique national catastrophe in that the actions of any one of us can impact other people's health, welfare, and actual life. And I think most people understand that. And the United States is failing to deal with this virus in almost catastrophic ways because, we have not internalized that fact in our public policy. But I do think that this basic issue, which is that the virus means we have a shared fate, has certain implications for public policy. So, for example, if we are as a country, we don't have universal paid leave, that means that people make trade-offs between staying home and being sick or going to their job and making money. They make a trade-off there. Low-income workers make a trade-off there that other workers don't have to make. And I think if you see public policy, and I think that's understandable now, 80% of Americans support universal paid leave. It was much lower before the virus. And people, you know, there's stronger support for universal health care and a variety of policy proposals. And I also think there's a much deeper understanding that the federal government has to solve some of these problems. Sometimes we may think in the back and forth of the fourth coronavirus package that that understanding really isn't there. But the American people themselves have shifted. And I think in a sense, my view is that the range of discourse has shifted dramatically over the last several months, and agenda items that seemed completely impossible are now very much possible. Vice President Biden, a relative moderate, has talked about investing $2 trillion in climate-related jobs over a relatively short period of 4 years. So in my view, I think this book is focused absolutely on the right challenge of economic insecurity. And I absolutely agree that economic insecurity has been a driving force of politics. I would also agree with Camille that economic insecurity and economic and inequality are completely related. And, you know, there is public polling that voters support higher taxes on wealthier people, even absent investing that money in particular items. So, you know, they just want higher taxes on wealthier people. And to just spend a moment on taxes, given the enormous increase in economic wealth for the top 1-3% in the United States, but really concentrated wealth in the top 0.01%, higher taxes on wealthier people is not only popular, but I think part of a social contract that is important to actually accomplish any of these items. I don't take away from other forms of taxation, but I think that indeed higher taxes on wealthier people, and I would agree the capital gains tax or other mechanisms. I think we should just be candid. If we just return to the 95 tax code, you know, before the Bush tax cuts and before the 2017 tax cuts, that would be itself generate a lot more income, a lot more resources. So I guess I would say on a range of scales here, I'm just touching on a few things that I think the book is incredibly timely. But I also think we're in a moment where it is a book that seemed like it was reaching beyond the current conversation is now really in the mainstream of it. And that is not to undermine the hard work that will have to take place in 2021, but it is to say that it is my deep and profound hope and not wish, but real, I think a real opportunity to make change in a range of areas in 2021, if the stars align with the kind of Congress and the kind of president, where these policy changes that seem so difficult to accomplish will be in the mainstream of the policy discourse in Washington about change laws that could pass in 2021, because I think the public has shifted dramatically in its orientation on the federal government and its role in solving problems. We have Republicans in Congress who just this year signed on a package for $2.5 trillion of spending. And, you know, possibly you will have a mandate for governing in 2021 with different leadership that has outlined a pretty aggressive agenda. And so, you know, I'm really hopeful that these ideas cannot just be policy ideas, but become legislation in relatively short order. So with that, I'll turn it back.
All right. Thank you very much, Neera, and all of the discussions. And thank you, Michael, for the presentation. I neglected to mention earlier that if people listening in have questions, they can email them to events@brookings.edu, or they can tweet with the hashtag Wolf at the Door. Please send in comments. We'd be happy to address them. Let me just say very briefly, what I loved about the book so much was the way it wove together history, politics, law, and economics. And it's easy to get one of those or sometimes two of those, but it's hard to get kind of an integrated analysis. For me, that was very helpful. Variance led to a variety of insights that even if I knew each of the individual things, I hadn't put them together in my own head and understood the implications of them. So let me just start. Michael, is there anything you would like to say in response to the commentators before we go to a more general discussion?
I would like to make a couple of comments if I could. I really want to thank all three of the commentators for their thoughtful comments. But I do want to make clear that there's more agreement, I think, between Camille and I than was implied in her comments. That is, we talk about economic insecurity, and her concern was that we didn't talk enough about inequality. And then she focused, and I think quite appropriately, on racial inequalities impact of that politically. When we were concerned, and this is before the pandemic, and I think it's important, what our concern was that the spotlight had been put on the top 1% or the top 0.1% of the people, the millionaires and billionaires that Bernie Sanders and others like to talk about. And much of the evidence about how people think about inequality, which is consistent with what Camille said, is people sort of in their economic circumstances. I always like to use the example of a colleague of mine who at the law school was far more upset that he learned that another professor was getting $10,000 more than he was than that somebody downtown in New York City practicing law was making millions of dollars more than he was. And, you know, the American people don't want Jeff Bezos to have even $1 billion, but he's got hundreds of billions. And if you took half of his wealth or three quarters of his wealth, he'd still have too much wealth for people's taste. And so we were concerned, and we were particularly concerned that the slogan, "We are the 99%, was not describing an effective coalition. And as everyone here knows, the idea that 99% of the American people could agree on anything seems extremely unlikely at the moment, much less the idea that they would be an effective political coalition. And so that was the inequality that we were focused on. And we're very clear in the book that the nostalgia for what has been described as the Great Compression during the post-war era, when economic growth was supposedly spread more widely through the population, was, as we say, it was very good if you were a white male during the post-war era, but it was not good economically for African Americans or for women. And so I agree entirely that there is a lot of concern that people are worried about race and xenophobia. And, you know, it's not an accident that Donald Trump has proposed building a wall across the southern border rather than the northern border. And so race is obviously and has continued to be the American dilemma, as Madal put it. And I just want to make it clear that we don't disagree with that. And actually, we were quite careful that some of the examples of people that we talk about are African-American people suffering in this context. So we don't treat this as a white person's problem or as a white man's problem. It is everyone's problem who's in the middle or below, broadening the middle definition quite a bit. I also just want to say that I appreciate Neera's optimism. I'm glad to see that all the years in Washington have not diminished her optimism. I've always known her to be optimistic. And it may be the case that the window for policy is widening or will widen briefly. And this is where we are very concerned about setting priorities and achieving proximate goals. And I'm for paid leave. I think it would be a great improvement in people's lives. But I'm much more worried about the loss of jobs than I am about that. And I think that there are going to have to be some choices made, even if Neera's hopes for the November election all come true. And so I think it's important to think about this and the centrality of work to dignity, to actually family peace, you know, to the impact on the disability rolls for Social Security and so forth is so central for us that we thought that was the place to begin. We thought so before the virus struck. And at least I can't speak for Ian here, but at least I continue to think that those are hugely important, although I would like to see both paid family leave and the refundable child credits that Bob has suggested. But I want to thank you for both all the nice things everybody said about the book, but also for reading it and for taking seriously its discussion of both politics and policy. And I particularly want to thank Camille for bringing some of the politics and Bob, the political discussion, to the forefront, which I did not have time to do.
Thank you. One of the questions we got, which I think is a really good one, is how do you take your framework for coalition building and knowledge of the history, politics, economics, law, and apply that to an issue like family leave and early childhood care, and sort of make that, how does one make that as accepted and urgent as a national priority as K-12 education is?
Well, it is a very good question. There is in the book several pages on this issue and on education. And everyone, I think all of us and probably all of the people who have tuned into this are very worried about quality K-12 education and the huge needs in the country for improving across the board K-12 education. We really looked very hard at the education literature and talked to a lot of people about how one might move forward. And unfortunately, we could not, when all was said and done, come up with a solution to the problems of quality education that make it as hard for people who we are concerned about to build human capital as it is and has been for them to build financial capital. And I had the luxury in my house of having a daughter who's been teaching inner city children in New York, Boston, and now Oakland for a number of years. And I had her read these pages and ask her, and she had studied educational policy and so forth, ask her if we were being too harsh on the inability to create a coalition. And she said no. And we basically had argued that improving K-12 education is likely to happen because of the local nature of our education policy in the United States, either one district at a time or even one school at a time. Interestingly, because there is no structure that has been in place for a very long time for children who are below public school age, there have been experiments with universal pre-K in places like Oklahoma, Alabama's quality program has been rated very high. And so there are coalitions, I think, for improving the care of children and preschool and getting people up to a place where they're better able to go forward. And the evidence is that this education and good child care has a long-lasting effects on people's ability to earn income in later life. But as you know well, the disparity in America, the threats that we described earlier from technology and the like, are very disparate for people who've had a college education or more compared to people who've had only a high school education. A Yale or Columbia graduate views the fact that they may change jobs 10 or 12 times during a career as an opportunity. But for people who are limited in their resources and their educational backgrounds, this is hugely challenging. And it is the future of work, I fear. So there's a lot to be done, but you've got to start somewhere.
Thank you. Any of the discussants like to address this issue of how we build a coalition for family leave or early childhood?
Is it okay if I jump in on something here? You know, I think the childcare is an interesting fact, right? Because childcare, early learning is an interesting fact because at the local level, there has been bipartisan, almost nonpartisan support. You know, you've seen tremendous gains in blue and red states. I mentioned Oklahoma, Alabama had a big expansion. California had a big expansion under Newsom. So, but it is the case that we're in Washington, it had during the Obama years in particular really bogged down. President Obama proposed major expansions of early learning. You know, this is just to share, the Center for American Progress did joint events with the Chamber of Commerce around the importance of early learning. Back in the day, we highlighted governors who'd done that. But, you know, I think because of the role of negative partisanship in the United States, Congress, you know, nothing moved. And I think we, you know, have to really be honest about this negative partisanship and what it means. Having said that, I also think we could be at the cusp of a different kind of politics. And I think this is a great example. The support for childcare, early investments in early learning has grown dramatically over the last several years. It's like, when you pull it publicly, it's 75-80% strong support, particularly amongst non-college women of all races, white, black, Latino. They recognize childcare as a deep economic issue. Early learning is a deep economic issue. And I think let's just be honest. You know, if you live in a world where there is unified control, I should also add one additional point. Joe Biden has proposed the largest scale investment in childcare of any leader ever. You know, he's willing to spend $700 billion on basically creating a new childcare infrastructure in the country, dramatically supported by federal dollars. You know, it's almost like went without mention, but did a, you know, large scale proposal, you know, much greater than what Hillary proposed 4 years ago or in the discourse at all over the last several years. And I think this is a real issue, which is it's not just the coalition, it's the politics underlining it. We could be in a moment where it's a central component of a Biden agenda that he moves very quickly early on. And I think the real question is, do the tools of negative partisanship still hold sway? And if you aren't in a place where you have a strong majority in the Senate and people are willing to use reconciliation or end the filibuster. You know, I think an area where it was so entrenched just a mere, you know, very recently could see dramatic change in the course of a year.
I also just want to add to Neera's comments there that, and Michael's comments, that we also are in a moment now, particularly around childcare and paid family leave, right? where people recognize that childcare is actually going to be essential to getting this economy back.
Absolutely.
Right. So that coalition has broadened pretty significantly. Absent a Biden win, there's still, I think, a coalition there. And again, for paid family leave, you know, we're obviously not going to have a vaccine on January 1st. And it's going to be, you know, phased in over the period of a year. And having paid family leave is going to be really important for people to be able to move forward economically in a variety of different ways. That's already been demonstrated over the last 6 months since we, you know, coronavirus really got going in the U.S. And continues to be demonstrated. And I don't think there's going to be any difference between now and a year from now in understanding how important paid family leave is for families to be able to make it through, particularly a recession.
Great. Thank you. Bob, did you want to add anything?
No, why don't we move to the next question?
Okay, thanks. Michael, in your book, you talk about a lot about what you might call the micro impact of economic insecurity. That is, somebody loses their job. How do we design an unemployment system to compensate them fairly? How do we design an EITC? But I wanted to take a step back and look at what's causing this economic insecurity in the first place. What are the big driving forces? Financial instability, protectionism, slow growth, aging in society. I mean, what do you see as the big drivers of insecurity? Are they things that we just have to live with, or are they things that we can modify?
Well, I said that, to being very conventional about it, that globalization has had an impact. I think it's having less of an impact. At least imports are having less of an impact. We know tariffs are not successful. The cost per job and who they burden have made it clear that protectionism is not the answer to this problem, although there are forces in both parties that seem to like protectionism because it's symbolically important. But we really think that going forward, the big issue is going to be technological change. And it's not that technology will not create its own jobs. At least historically, changes, transformations in technology have created their own jobs. But it's going to require people to move, and in some cases to change what they're doing. And it's not, we're not talking about just, you know, driverless cars and cashierless grocery stores. In the same way that Neera and Camille have pointed out, that the virus has opened up a window for opportunities with regard to things like paid family leave and childcare. The virus has also stimulated huge innovations, not the least of which are the improvements in the Zoom technology that we're now using, where you have entrepreneurs and software designers creating more and more ways that work can be done both from home and remotely and other sorts of ways. And this is going to continue. So I think, and we're not going to roll the clock back on technology. And while we might want to create barriers at our borders for people and or goods and services, both of which I think are a mistake, you can't create barriers to technological change. We're not going to. The Luddites of machine-breaking eras are not coming back. And so we have to adapt to technology, and I think that is threatening, and it is particularly threatening to people who do not have college educations and are not sort of grown up in a way that their skills enable them to be nimble in a rapidly changing job market. And so that is, I think, both an opportunity, but also a very, very important threat going forward.
Could I say something here to just add and add to what was the, Professor Gratz's remarks, if it's okay? I think we live in a dangerous time. I think Professor Gratz is really, the focus on economic insecurity is really important. I think there's a dangerous time for innovation, because I think we live in a time where economic insecurity is driving a discourse that is so anti-elite, it is becoming opposed to going to college. And you now see a polarization across party lines about ideas like going to college, which is in some way like incredibly dangerous to America's innovation edge in the future. And I think this is an argument as laid out and as is clearly stated for these sets of policies. But I also, I would go in a kind of radical direction, which is, you know, over the last 10 or 15 years, really decades, America is innovating sufficiently. Our economy is not, you know, we are generating lots of wealth. This economy generates a lot of wealth. This rise of insecurity has taken place against the backdrop of huge corporate profits and lots of wealth creation. We're not at 4% GDP, but, you know, at an economy our size, even 2% GDP is still generating substantial amounts of wealth. The real challenge, and this goes to Camille's point, is that it is distributed incredibly unequally. And, you know, from my social contract piece, the point I really thought was, you know, if we just distribute the benefits a little bit more equally, you know, we could create a lot more economic security. So, you know, tax the wealthy a lot more and create jobs in areas that we have mass needs. You know, the market is not responding to climate. The market is not responding to childcare. So that is why the government needs to respond in those areas, and it can put people to work doing so. And, you know, I mean, I think this is an important framework. In a sense, it's a slightly different framework for the same kind of policy proposals. But at the end of the day, we could live in a much fairer country that still is innovating dramatically, but also addresses that economic security. If we just think about, you know, ensuring that wealthy people are taxed at a rate perhaps where they were in 1995. And I think a side benefit of that is that, and I think this is really a point of the book, is that if people are feeling more economically secure, then the anti-elitism that is truly counterproductive from a long-term competitiveness position, you know, we could address that concern as well.
Great.
Can I just say one word about the anti-elitism? I mean, it's something that we were very concerned about in the book.
Yes, absolutely.
And we quote Michael Gove, who said, you know, people are tired of elites. They don't want to listen to any experts anymore. And as you know well, Donald Trump was really effective in running an anti-expert, anti-elite campaign, of the sort that we hadn't seen since George Wallace ran a similar campaign in the 60s and early 70s. So I think this is a very, very big problem. And I just want to be clear, it's been mentioned so many times, I just want to be clear, we talk in the book, and I'm for raising taxes on high-income people and equalizing some of that. I'm skeptical, as Bob mentioned, of a wealth tax for obvious constitutional reasons. But the key is where you're going to spend the money and where you're going to create the jobs. And when we talk about infrastructure, we don't leave out climate change. Creating a system of electricity distribution and transportation would be enormously helpful to climate change. There's so many needs that it is the jobs program that would be funded with those taxes that I think is of primary importance.
Yes, exactly. Correct.
I just wanted to add one additional point to this, you know, question about what creates insecurity. And I think part of it is there is just very little attention and very little political power when it comes to the quality of jobs that have been created. So in the pre-pandemic, you know, era, 53 million Americans between the ages of 18 to 64, that accounts for about 44% of all workers, qualified as low wage. So, you know, over the past several years, we've created millions of jobs. When you look at the quality of those jobs, you see a persistent shift towards low paying jobs. And those low paying jobs, which you have to stack up multiple of them to be able to make ends meet, is what creates insecurity. So as we're thinking about creating employment, we also have to have a coalition of folks who are interested in creating quality jobs, that is jobs with benefits and that pay a living wage.
Right. And I just, if I could just say one additional word, I mean, the truth is this is obviously all in the book and all these issues, but just to highlight here, the challenge in the United States is you can have jobs and be incredibly insecure because you won't have health care and you don't have a pension and you don't have like basic benefits, which is very unusual. In other countries, you have benefits through the state, not through the employment, but through the state. In the United States, you know, plenty of people are deeply insecure in jobs they have because, you know, even with their job, they get sick, or their child gets sick, that costs them tremendous amounts of money, or you know, something happens, or they, you know, they have really basically much less retirement ability to retire, even with Social Security, than many other people. So, you know, but I think again, this is a point in the book and the point of the book.
I would just add to make an extremely obvious point with respect to Michael's comments about anti-elitism and skepticism of experts. I mean, what better illustration than the degree to which tens of millions of Americans don't wear masks or socially distance amidst the worst pandemic in 100 years and do not trust the scientists and the experts explaining how crucial that is? What more evidence would one need?
I mean, and also we'd be like Japan if we had universal mask wearing at this point. We'd be able to have an R-1. But anyway.
All right. Let me ask one more question. Michael, I've gotten a number of comments from people that I'm going to summarize a little, maybe a little too simply as follows. This plan is great for lower middle class and middle class households, but it doesn't address the seriously poor, the underclass, the people in poverty. And I'm wondering if you think that's obviously a book can't do everything, but I'm wondering if you think that's a fair comment, or, you know, you were focused on these other issues, or if the book does cover the kind of the long-term poor, the underclass people, you know, with that are not getting enough food to eat and live in abject poverty.
I think that's a fair comment in some sense. That is, we are focused broadly on people who are low wage workers and up well into the middle class, and people who are living without any income and have had no income are people who we're very concerned with. But it is not the focus of the book. Creating more jobs and better jobs and making work pay better would certainly create opportunities for people who are now poor and not working. So in some sense, we're hoping that the kinds of things we're talking about would make their lives better. But it is not focused on the kinds of programs that are designed to make transfers to people who are out of work. We don't talk about disability insurance. We don't talk about SSI. We don't talk about food stamps much. We don't talk about programs that are extremely important for those people, but it's just not the topic that we're really focused on.
If I could jump in here, as Michael sort of just alluded to, I actually think, Michael, in the answer you just gave, you could have made a little stronger answer in your own defense. A number of the proposals you do make would indeed reduce poverty, substantially enlarging the EITC, if infrastructure and jobs investments are designed in the right way with a particular focus on people in communities who have difficulty getting good paying jobs and entering the labor market. I assume that your call for unemployment insurance reform includes reforms of the problems in the UI system today, under which very large numbers of low wage and part-time workers are ineligible for UI when they're laid off, and they should be eligible. You call for a path to universal health coverage, universal pre-K, and major advances in childcare, all of which would be helpful. I'd reiterate in my remarks, whatever, 30, 40 minutes ago, I had some addendums to your list, and virtually all of them are aimed at the poverty issue, making the child tax credit fully refundable, major investments in low-income housing, particularly for low-income renters, subsidized jobs programs for people having difficulty entering the labor market, which could include, for example, people recently released from jail or prison mm-hmm. have difficulty getting the first job, increases in the minimum wage and the like. And while they weren't in my list, I would also love to see in the agenda for the years to, in the list that I mentioned in my opening remarks, I also have in my broader list and would love to see in the years ahead an expansion, an increase in the size of the basic SNAP or food stamp benefit, and long overdue improvements in the Supplemental Security Income Program, the basic HSA program for low-income people who are elderly or have disabilities, the parameters of which in most cases have not been adjusted, in some cases not even adjusted for inflation, since 1974 when the program first began to operate. But I think if you supplemented the list in the book with these kinds of things, you would have a pretty robust platform on poverty as well as the related issue of economic insecurity.
Right, and I would just say that we know what helps. We've lived experience that a very tight labor market, so with large sales investments in infrastructure broadly and childcare, you know, that requires a lot of people. And if you, as Bob said, structure it right, a significant way, probably one of our better ways, in addition to the ITC and the many things Bob has talked about to address long-term poverty and the deeply poor, is a very tight labor market, particularly in communities that haven't seen those very tight labor markets. And that is a way you can structure public policy, these kinds of investments, to address that challenge.
I mean, in a nutshell, we need tight labor markets.
Yeah.
We need stronger supports for people working at low wages, some through employer requirements, minimum wage, overtime, et cetera. And some through things like the EITC. And we need a strengthened safety net for people who have no or very low wages, including families that have no earnings, who have been hurt a lot by changes in the safety net in recent decades. And I think the first step, I'm repeating myself, in making progress there would be to make the child tax credit fully refundable, get that full credit to every child, including children in single-parent families without earnings.
All right. Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Neera. Michael, it's your book. You get the last word.
Well, I want to agree with Neera and Bob about supplements for the poor, and especially agree with Bob. Bob's defense that the programs that we've described would also help alleviate poverty. And in another book, I've actually talked a lot about the need to improve supplements for rental housing. We in this book do criticize the efforts to make everybody a homeowner, which we really regard as good politics and bad policy, I think, is the wrong policy, I think, is the way we describe it in the book. But I just want to thank everybody for what has been an extremely interesting and thoughtful conversation. And I appreciate the fact that many of you, Camille, Bob, and Neera, have all been in the front lines of trying to make people's lives more secure and to raise them up from where they are now. And I want to thank especially Bill and Brookings again for having this conference. And I hope that many of the listeners will take home these ideas, and that at least some of them would actually read the book.
Well, but go in the opposite order.
All right. Well, thank you, Michael, for sharing your outstanding book with us. Thank you, Camille, Bob, and Nira for superb comments.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was
thank
fabulous.
Thank you to the audience, for listeners, for your questions and comments, and for tuning in. And have a wonderful day.
Thank you.